Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Susan Shand, Brian Lynn, and Anna Mateo. Later, Ashley Thompson and Katie Weaver have a special report on one of America's national treasures. But first, this report. Timing is everything. That is an expression people around the world use in many situations. Generally, this expression means that taking action at the right time can be just as important as how well you do something. This is especially true when a student is seeking admission to a college or university, says Becky Konowitz. She is Assistant Dean of Undergraduate Admission at Santa Clara University, a private Jesuit school in Santa Clara, California. Konowitz notes that applying to colleges and universities in the United States can often be a long and complex process. This is partly because of recent changes to the admissions policies at many schools and increasing competition among applicants.
Part of the complexity of today is students are applying to more universities that have more variations in deadlines and requirements, Konowitz told VOA. And so it requires even more organization. Back when I applied years ago, I applied to 3 schools. Now, the average student applies to 6 to 8 schools. What many students and their families fail to understand, Konowitz adds, is just how long the application process takes. Many people think the process begins in the final year of high school. However, Konowitz says students should start taking action well before that. In the U.S., young people generally attend high school for 4 years. And Konowitz suggests students take their first step towards applying to college in the months before their 3rd year. At this point, young people are still likely to have several unanswered questions on their minds. Those questions could be as complex as, what do you want out of your college experience? Or as simple as, where do you want to study? Konowitz says students can get closer to finding the answers by visiting any college or university. It is not important if the student does not plan on attending the school. The visit can still give them a better idea of what to expect in that kind of environment. Visit a university. See what it's like, she said. Check into an admissions office. It doesn't matter the size or where it is. Stop in on one. You may be on a family holiday, and that gives you a sense. And then it might also spark some questions to help you start going to online resources.
The next step, Konowitz says, involves testing. Most U.S. students take exams to prove their level of academic performance in the second half of their 3rd year in high school. These tests include the SAT, once known as the Scholastic Aptitude Test, and the ACT. Some schools like one test more than the other. Conowitz adds that this is also the time when international students should be taking tests like the TOEFL and IELTS to prove their abilities in English. After taking these tests, the period between the third and fourth years of high school is a busy one for high school students, she says. This is the time when they should be narrowing the list of colleges and universities under consideration. Then, once they have made a shorter list, they should contact these schools and try to build a relationship with them. Conowitz notes many schools have email lists that students and family members can join. The school's emails can provide helpful information, she says. Also, college admissions officers often set up informational events, both at their schools and elsewhere, which students should attend. This will give students a chance to meet the people who may be considering their applications, she says. The next step is for students to begin working on a writing sample. Most U.S. colleges and universities require applicants to provide a writing sample that does more than show off their writing ability level. It also tells admissions officers more about who the applicants are.
Conowitz argues that creating a good writing sample takes time, and students often need several attempts to get it right. So students should begin working on it even before their final year of high school. Also at this time, students should create a document clearly detailing the different requirements and closing dates for the schools to which they are applying. Once the final year of high school begins, students should get all the required materials together and ready for submission, Conowitz says. This includes putting the finishing touches on the essay and any documents needed for financial aid. Also, students need to ask teachers and others with whom they have strong connections to write letters in support of their application. Conowitz says most U.S. colleges and universities require letters of recommendation, and it can take a while for someone to write one. So, students should make their requests for these at least 30 days before the closing date. Finally, in the United States, most deadlines for college application materials are in early winter. But Conowitz suggests that students should submit all their application materials a week before the actual date. That way, if any emergencies come up or mistakes were made, students have plenty of time to contact the schools if necessary.
Conowitz notes that spring is when most schools make their decisions and inform candidates if they will accept them. However, she says students should contact the schools a week after submitting their materials to ensure that there are no problems. If problems, such as missed deadlines, do exist, admissions officers will try their best to help. I would encourage parents to remember that an admissions office can be their ally, Conowitz said. So, if a student has missed a deadline, encourage your student to call us, and then we'll help them through the process. The hardest part is when the parent takes over. Then we start to wonder, can this student develop these independent skills? And would they be a good fit for our university? Admissions officers want to be as helpful as possible, she argues. Some will even send messages to applicants' smartphones to restate upcoming deadlines and provide useful information. After all, Conowitz notes that helping students apply to college is why most admissions officers started working in this field to begin with. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Susan Shand.
Now it's time for Words and Their Stories. On this program, we explore common expressions in American English. Today, we talk about expressions that began behind the wheels of automobiles. Now, they are common expressions that we use in everyday conversations.
Well, let's not delay any longer. Let's get this show on the road. To get the show on the road means to begin something as soon as possible. It's a casual expression that we use when we want to start something, anything, an activity or project or an actual road trip. Well, not any activity. You would not likely use this expression to begin something sad, such as a funeral. It is a light-hearted expression.
Word experts say that the phrase comes from traveling circuses and other shows of the early 1900s in the United States. These entertainers would travel from town to town, bringing their performances to people not able to travel to big cities for entertainment. So the person who says, "Hey, let's get this show on the road," is taking charge. They want to start things. They want to get things going. You could say they are in the driver's seat. Just as the driver is in control of their vehicle, the person in the driver's seat of an activity, event, or project is also in control. They are the leader. Feel free to use this phrase in any situation, formal or informal.
Speaking of free, most rides are not. They cost money. When you take a taxi, you must pay for it. If you drive a car, you must pay for gas, repairs, and insurance. It is great when you get a free ride to where you are going. However, in life, to get a free ride means to gain from something without having to do anything in exchange. It can be annoying to have a friend or coworker who is always trying to get a free ride. They do not give. They just take, take, take.
Now, when we are actually driving, the phrase "go down that road" simply means to drive down a road. We would say this when we give directions. Go down that road for about a mile, and you'll see your destination on the right. But in conversation, it has an interesting meaning. To go down that road means to make a decision. But it's more than that. It also means that this decision may bring trouble or leave you in a difficult place. We often use this phrase as a warning or when we give advice to someone.
Let's say a good friend, Veronica, has a neighbor who likes causing trouble. He has loud parties every weekend until the wee hours of the night. The trash from his parties often spills out into her lawn. Veronica tells you she is going to get even with this neighbor. She plans to play opera music very loudly, very early every morning until his late, loud parties stop. You might tell her, "Are you sure you want to go down that road? It could lead to trouble." Maybe you have made the same mistake. You could advise your friend, I've been down that road before, and it did not go as I had planned.
Where the rubber meets the road is another interesting phrase. Here, rubber refers to the tires of a vehicle. Where the rubber meets the road is the point of contact between automobile tires and the road. It's when and where the car actually moves. It's also when you find out how the car performs. So the expression rubber meets the road means the point at which a product, idea, or method is tested. Imagine you have been studying different methods of teaching people English. So far, it has all been theories. Where the rubber meets the road will be in a class full of students. That will be the real test. Will those theories actually help your students learn English? We shall see.
Some driving behaviors are really dangerous and can lead to accidents. For example, when you cut someone off in traffic, you turn your car into their lane in a dangerous way, nearly hitting them. You can also cut people off in conversation. Used in this way, to cut someone off, or cut off someone, means to interrupt what they are saying. It is not dangerous, but it is extremely annoying.
Driving in the middle of the road is really dangerous. You could crash into oncoming traffic. But in conversation, being in the middle of the road is actually a really safe place. It means you are taking a moderate position on some issue. You are not at or near one extreme or the other. The most dangerous driving behavior is not paying attention to the road. Many wrecks happen when people do not pay attention. The worst thing, by far, is to fall asleep at the wheel.
We also use this expression in our conversations. To be asleep at the wheel means you are not paying attention to something that should have your attention. If the leader of a project is asleep at the wheel, it means she's not paying attention to the project. Something bad will probably happen. We here at Learning English are definitely not asleep at the wheel.
That's right. We pay very close attention to our audience. And that's the end of this Words and Their Stories.
I'm Brian Lynn.
And I'm Anna Mateo.
This week, we explore a national park and UNESCO World Heritage Site in the American Southwest. This national park, near the city of Carlsbad, New Mexico, is unusual in a major way. It is mostly underground. Carlsbad Caverns National Park contains more than 100 caves below the surface of the desert. Most are closed to the public, but anyone can visit the main attraction, one of the largest caves in the world. Huge, incredible, inspiring. Words like these come to mind as visitors enter a world of silence, darkness, and cold, almost 230 meters under the ground. An elevator lowers you into the world of Carlsbad Cavern. It is silent, except for the quiet voices of guides and visitors. It is not fully dark, though. The National Park Service has enough lighting to see many of the beautiful formations all around. The temperature in the cave is about 13 degrees Celsius.
A cavern is a large cave, but Carlsbad Cavern is really a long series of chambers. One of these is called the Big Room. The Big Room measures more than 3 hectares. The ceiling is 77 meters high. The Big Room is the single largest underground chamber ever found in North America. The Big Room and other parts of the cavern contain huge, sharp formations of minerals. People are free to explore the lit formations in the Big Room, but park rangers must guide visitors to other areas of the cave. Stalactites hang from the ceiling. Stalagmites rise from the floor. Some even meet to create a column. Other formations look like needles, popcorn, pearls, and flowers.
One of the first questions visitors might have is, how did Carlsbad Cavern form? Guides explain that it did not result from the action of waterways like other limestone caves. Its creator was sulfuric acid. The limestone developed about 250 million years ago. Then, within the last 20 million years, movements in the earth pushed the rock upward, forming the Guadalupe Mountains. Today, these mountains extend from West Texas into southeast New Mexico. The action of oil and natural gas created hydrogen sulfide in the limestone. The hydrogen sulfide reacted with oxygen in rainwater moving through the rock. Sulfuric acid developed. The acid created the caves by dissolving the limestone in its path. Later, the water and most of the acid left the caves as the Guadalupe Mountains continued to rise. This permitted fresh water to move through. The fresh water left behind minerals. These minerals became the formations and shapes on the ceilings, walls, and floors of the caves.
People are not the only visitors to Carlsbad Caverns National Park. About 400,000 Mexican free-tailed bats come from Mexico every summer to give birth in the big cave. As the sun goes down each day, thousands of adult bats fly out of the cave. It can take from 20 minutes to more than 2 hours for them all to leave. They go to nearby river valleys to feed on insects. Then, toward morning, they return to the bat cave within Carlsbad Cavern. Park Service rangers explain that mother bats find their babies by remembering their location, their smell, and the sound of their cry. Mothers and their babies, called pups, hang in groups on the ceiling. They spend the day resting and feeding. While the adults go out at night for food, the young bats hang out in the cave for 4 or 5 weeks. Then, in July or August, they join their mothers on these nightly flights. Finally, in late October or early November, the bats all leave and return to Mexico. But they always come back the next year.
It is possible that it was the bats that led ancient people to discover the cave. Archaeologists and others have found evidence of Ice Age hunters near the cave entrance. They have also found pieces of spear points left about 10,000 years ago. More recently, Apache Indians painted pictures at the entrance, and evidence of one of their cooking areas was found beside a nearby path. Around 1900, a teenage cowboy named James Larkin White began to explore the cave. Jim White told his story in the 1932 book, The Discovery and History of Carlsbad Caverns. Here is a reading of his description of his first sight of the bats and the big cave.
I thought it was a volcano, but then I'd never seen a volcano, nor never before had I seen bats swarm, for that matter. During my life on the range, I'd seen plenty of prairie whirlwinds, but this thing didn't move. It remained in one spot, spinning its way upward. I watched it for perhaps a half hour, until my curiosity got the better of me. Then I began investigating.
Jim White told how he built a ladder from rope, wire, and sticks, and returned to the entrance of the cave a few days later.
Standing at the entrance of the tunnel, I could see ahead of me a darkness so absolutely black it seemed a solid. The light of my lantern was but a sickly glow. Nevertheless, I forged ahead, and with each step the tunnel grew larger, and I felt as though I was wandering into the very core of the Guadalupe Mountains.
Several years later, in 1918, Jim White took a professional photographer into the cave. Ray Davis's pictures of the big room appeared in the New York Times newspaper. National interest began to grow. In 1923, scientists from the National Geographic Society explored the caves. The following year, President Calvin Coolidge named Carlsbad a national monument. Presidents can declare national monuments, but Congress must act to establish a national park. And that is what Congress did in 1930. Since then, parts of Carlsbad Caverns have been used for movie sets, weddings, even meetings of the Carlsbad City Council. Most visitors go to the main cavern, but some experienced cavers are permitted to explore five wild caves in the park. And in another one, scientists are studying microbes in search of a cure for cancer.
As for Jim White, he became chief ranger of Carlsbad Caverns. In one story in his book, he talks about all of the work that was done in the area.
I doubt if you can understand how happy this modernizing has made me. It's like the pleasant end to a dream.
I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Katie Weaver.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.